KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners' weekly meeting for this week's public health updates on COVID-19, live from the Jefferson County Courthouse. This is KPTZ, Fort Townsend.
And also, thanks to the Developmental Disabilities Board and all the volunteers in the community. There's a lot of people that step up and do things for free, so appreciate that.
Building blocks to getting those folks into those jobs too. So that's
I was just going to say the service providers that help do the placement and match employers with people with disabilities. So it really is a concerted effort by many.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Everyone have a good National Disability Employment Month. And it's 9:45, so let's welcome the listeners of KPTZ, as well as Dr. Locke and Willie Bentz for our weekly COVID updates. And Dr. Locke, how are we doing?
Well, good morning. In terms of the COVID pandemic, cases are going up, both nationally and within our state. And this may well be what we've long anticipated and actually have been preparing quite a bit for, which many call the third wave of the infection. Nationally, cases have gone up by 38% in the last 2 weeks. So it's a significant increase, although fortunately the death rate has not gone up at all. And that's remained less than 500 deaths per day, in contrast to what we were seeing in the summer, where it was over 1,000 a day and some days closer to 2,000. So, and I get into it in a moment, some of the reasons why that is. We're in the U.S. We're especially seeing a surge in the northern states in the Midwest. So places like North and South Dakota, Montana, Wisconsin, Nebraska. These are now the hardest hit states, and not coincidentally, these are the states too that have resisted masking mandates. So masking is not required. The philosophy is that it's a personal responsibility kind of issue, and it certainly is our personal responsibility. But we know that masking mandates work. We're also seeing in those northern states a significant kind of impact from the Sturgis motorcycle rally that occurred in mid-August, and it really illustrates how long it takes for an event like that to trigger widespread outbreaks. That was now about 8 weeks ago, and we're still seeing the ripples of that as people went to this rally and then sort of moved back around the country. So that's a serious situation. The hospitals are starting to fill up. ICU beds are scarce. And just as we dealt with in March, that's one of our big concerns is surge capacity. Whereas most people with COVID-19 will recover at home without medical care, those that need medical care often need intensive care. Here in Jefferson County, we added one new case over the weekend. So we'll, at least by my count, we'll have 9 cases over the last 2 weeks, and that will put our case per 100,000 just a little above 28 cases per 100,000. So that's a slight increase from previous weeks, although still, in this what's considered to be the moderate to low range. Clallam County, for the first time in a long time, is lower than Jefferson County, which is great. So their case rate is 20 cases per 100,000. And Kitsap is the highest in the region with 58 per 100,000. And there are percent positivity of tests reflect those trends too. It's less than 1% of tests are positive in Jefferson County. It's 1.6% in Clallam, and it's 2.1% in Kitsap. So we are bracing for a third wave. We think these next 3 months may be the most difficult yet in the pandemic. And there's a lot of things driving that. The weather is not in our favor. As it gets colder, of course, people stay indoors more. This is the time of year that schools and universities have reconvened. That's a driver. Holiday gatherings are a factor. And even the air temperature can be a factor. That as things get colder and drier, that promotes the survival of viruses. In Western Washington, though, most people would not describe our winters as being dry. Most of the time, things are not frozen, and in fact, it's quite humid. And humidity works against the transmission of viruses because the humidity causes the airborne droplets to stick to the water vapor, and so they become heavier and drop out of the air. So aerosols don't move as far when the weather is humid. The quarantine fatigue, as people have often called it, is a real factor. You know, people, we have a number of studies that suggest that people are so tired of the restrictions that they're abandoning them. They're increasing their risk behavior. They're mingling more with other families and friends, and unfortunately the virus doesn't care if you're tired of the pandemic or not. Things spread based on risk patterns. We're still dealing with the consequences of what was essentially a lack of a national strategy, a national testing strategy. If anything, things have gotten worse in terms of the leadership vacuum. The fact that the CDC that should be leading this is really in the back seat on it, and we're doing it state by state. And many states, including our own, I think, are doing a very good job, but you can't really deal with the pandemic optimally state by state because we don't all stay within our states. There's a huge amount of travel and commerce amongst the states. So inevitably, the infection moves from the states where there's high levels of activity to those with low activity. But I would emphasize, too, there's a lot of positive developments that we should factor in and that will help us in the next 3 months. Our clinical management of this disease continues to get better and better. And that's why the death rates have been staying down. And also, it has an effect on hospitalization. We're getting better at treating people so they can stay home. They don't even need to be in hospitals, or they don't. If they're in the hospital, they don't need to be on ventilators. So those are all real improvements. We're learning more and more about the transmission of it, and we're trying to translate that into our strategies for preventing transmission. Really, the big thing there is that the role of droplets and aerosols and the importance of masking. Every new study tells us that masks are more important than we previously thought. This very simple strategy can dramatically reduce transmission. And one of the reasons, and another thing we've been learning, is this is what's known as an over-dispersed illness. And without getting into the mathematics of dispersion, what that means, in essence, is the infection is not spread evenly by all people who are infected. That we now have pretty good evidence that 10 to 20% of people result in about 80% of transmission. So what's been commonly called super spreaders are really the essence of this pandemic. And so we're adjusting our strategies to look for those super spreader events. And we think, you know, as we figure out how to do that, that we'll get better and better at controlling outbreaks. And masking is important with super spreaders because super spreaders, by and large, don't know they're infected. And so they're out there moving around. And if a super spreader has a mask on, they're very unlikely to transmit the infection. If they don't have a mask on, then they can infect, 50, 60, 100 people if they're involved in a crowded event, especially an indoor event. So we're trying to translate that into what we're doing. And then we have new testing technologies. The United States bought 150 million of these portable testing carts called Binax Now. Washington State is now getting 150,000 of them a week. And they'll be coming to hospitals and schools and nursing homes and jails and prisons. And we're trying to figure out how to use them best. And it appears that, whereas they're not as sensitive as the lab tests, they will miss some infections. What they're probably best at is picking up people that are highly contagious. So people that have a lot of virus in their system, they're more likely to test positive on these simple 15-minute tests. And that's really important information because it's the highly infectious people who are potentially the super spreaders. And so we'll be using those test kits and they are arriving as we speak. Just to update areas, the schools remain open. They're doing a fabulous job in terms of screening students and following all the safety protocols. We're actually doing a major revision of our screening protocols this week. We've agreed on a protocol within the three counties of Clallam, Jefferson, and Kitsap, and we think it will be much easier, much more more realistic and sustainable than what we started with. And especially it will emphasize that children with these mild, non-specific illnesses or symptoms that go away within 24 hours are really not the ones we want to focus on. They just need to stay home till their symptoms go away. And we'll be focusing much more on people who have symptoms that are far more suspicious for COVID-19. So we'll be... I'll be meeting with the school superintendents, and we'll go over all this tomorrow morning. Yes, Mr. Murphy.
So with the different school districts, Dr. Locke, what is the status of sports events and also for transportation, busing? What kind of precautions are in place there to reduce transmission?
Well, they've had their protocols in effect with the busing from the very beginning, which strict masking, separating the students as much as possible. The drivers, of course, are wearing protection. And so far, we've not been seeing outbreaks or transmissions linked to busing. And we're also basing part of it, in some cases, they cannot maintain 6-foot separation on buses at all times. But the exposure periods in buses are for fairly short intervals, and they have windows open, and a moving bus can be very well ventilated. Mm-hmm. If you have some windows cracked. So we're relying on those, but masking is critical. In buses. And then sports is just kind of coming online. And there's no competition between schools, but schools are starting to do more sporting events and scrimmaging and things like that. And there are risks associated with it. It's a very difficult decision because do you start up your sports programs with all the benefit that has for people, both psychologically and physically, but also risk potentially shutting your schools down by triggering an outbreak. So it's a really difficult balancing act, and all the schools are wrestling with that and a little bit differently. But the state has put out some standards for school sports, and they will be starting up to some degree, and especially the low-risk sports. Everyone agrees that the low-risk sports are a good idea. It's more the contact sports that we're concerned about, where you can't wear a mask because you're really exerting yourself and you're in very close physical contact. That's kind of the point of the sport in many ways. Things like football is you're trying to minimize your distance to other people rather than to maximize it. And then finally, Halloween coming up. I just wanted to mention we're doing a program at the health department. We put up stands, 5 different stands around the county where kids can, it's got information about safe Halloween. It has these coloring sheets that they can take. And then if they fill them out, if they color them and bring them back to us, they get a free mask and a sweet treat. Is what they're calling it, which is a bag of candy, basically. So that's our version of trick or treat, and we're putting a lot of information out on our website about how to do safe trick or treating. We think it can be done safely, but parents have to really kind of reinvent the holiday a little bit to make sure it doesn't end up spreading the infection. Then I've had a number of great questions from KPTZ this week, starting with someone is saying they've been able to get some N95 masks. They've been wearing them in public spaces, and ask about is there ways to clean or disinfect them. And indeed, there are. That for just routine public use, generally just allowing the mask to dry. A minimum of 3 days. Some people think 5 to 7 days is better, but the minimum is 3 days. And drying deactivates any virus that might be on the mask. And there are more elaborate ways. If you are using the mask in a medical setting, there are protocols where you can put it in an oven, for instance, at 158 degrees, keep it there for an hour. That will reliably disinfect the mask, but it's hard on the rubber straps that hold the mask on. So generally, drying is okay. We still are having shortages of N95 masks. And so there's a mask very similar to an N95 called a KN95. That we encourage people to use those when they can. They're not certified in the same way of N95s, but we don't use KN95s for first responders or in hospitals. So you're not competing with that supply. There was a question asking us, if we could publish more data with some graphs that look at local spikes and clusters. And we are looking at that all the time, and we are publishing more and more data that we think might be useful to people. With our small numbers, we don't have much data in terms of spikes and clusters. COVID-19 cases are much more random than that in Jefferson County, and most of them represent out-of-county exposures. So visitors or travel out of state, just the nature of this reporting system is that someone can be in Seattle and acquire the infection in Seattle and get tested there. But if they're a Jefferson County resident, they will be counted in Jefferson County, even though they may have never stepped foot in the county during their infection. So that Looking at spikes and clusters and risk events, we have to do that large on a larger scale, regional or even statewide is how we're trying to learn about those things. There was a question asked. I've remarked many times that we think there are in the order of 9 to 10 cases for every confirmed case of COVID. And the question was, do we still think that? And the answer is yes. There's been a number of studies of this. They're what are called seroprevalence studies, where you do antibody tests of the population and see who's been infected without knowing it. And Washington is actually now starting up a huge statewide seroprevalence study that will give us some much better information, and it'll involve all the large population counties of the state, and then I think it was six or nine rural counties were selected randomly to be part of the study, and Jefferson County is one of them. So people in Jefferson County will be getting phone calls or letters from the University of Washington randomly asking if they want to be part of this statewide seroprevalence study, and it means giving a blood sample, and they'll tell you the results, of course. But that's how we figured out, and the studies that have been done have shown anywhere from a factor of 2 to 12 is the ratio between confirmed cases to actual cases. In the real high impact areas, it's sometimes only as high as 2 times as many. But if you look all around the country, and especially what we think is going on in Washington State, we think it's about 1 to 10. So the confirmed cases are the tip of the iceberg, and the iceberg is about 10 times larger.
Dr. Locke, just to follow up on that, I'm not backing off on anything or something, but does our 1% positive test, is that a variable in this? And I'm also wondering about the, if 75% of our cases come from out of county contacts, would you still, I don't understand how that data lines up to suggest the iceberg in Jefferson County. I realize we live in a region that's not, doesn't have closed borders, so it's not really not relevant, but how do you account for those data points?
Right, we cannot necessarily generalize the state data. So the 1 to 10 ratio is really looking at the whole state. And we simply don't know if that ratio is as high in Jefferson County. It actually probably isn't. That in the lower prevalence rural areas in the state, there are probably fewer than 1 in 10. But we don't know that for sure. And fortunately, we'll be getting some data that will shed some more light on that. So we really do know what the true prevalence in rural Washington is. That really hasn't been studied yet. So we're just guessing. But yes, I agree with that. Given our patterns and where we're seeing a lot of out-of-county exposure, we may not have that many people who are just asymptomatically infected. Although we certainly have some, because we know the infection is spread all over the state. There was a question about the definition of quarantine, and noted that they had some friends who were diagnosed with COVID-19, mild symptoms, but thought it was okay to travel around. And asked, if people have cell phones, do we have some way of tracking that? That actually has been used by some other countries. We don't do it in this country for privacy reasons, but we do call people who are in isolation and quarantine. We call them every day to see how they're doing, but also to remind them of what they need to be doing. And there's two categories. People with infection are actually in what we call isolation. And this is really strict. This is, no work, no travel. And in fact, you keep away from your household members, any non-infected household members. You also do everything you can to not infect them. And that's a period that lasts for about 10 days from your onset of symptoms. And then quarantine actually refers to people who have been exposed to the infection, but we don't know yet whether they're infected or not. And so they're in a 14-day period of a kind of isolation, not quite as strict as if you have the infection, but it's also you stay home, no travel, no grocery shopping. You have other people do that for you, no work or school. And then we test people who are in quarantine at about 7 to 8 days after their exposure, and that's our best way of seeing if they're in fact infected or not. And we've had this happen again and again in Jefferson County, where people who are in quarantine end up being infected, but because they were in quarantine, no one else got exposed. And so that is really what we're trying to accomplish in all of this. There was question about herd immunity and what they are now calling the Great Barrington Declaration, which is a kind of this notion that you can somehow identify and protect people who are at risk for COVID complications, and then everyone else can more or less do whatever they want. I think I might have mentioned at the Board of Health meeting, Dr. Fauci summarizes very well as being complete nonsense, that it just doesn't work. You can't identify people who are at risk, or at least you can't identify all of them. Not all old people are at risk. Not all young people are not at risk. There are probably 100 million Americans who fall into this vulnerable category for one reason or another. So that's a huge group. And if you were to just let the infection spread through the community, it would be impossible to protect those people because their opportunities for infection would just be greater and greater. So we know this with certainty. We could stand back and do nothing, and the pandemic would come to an end in a shorter period. But the cost would be in millions of deaths, and that's why we're not doing that. We also don't know how long naturally acquired immunity lasts. Probably somewhere between 3 months and 1 year, but that's it. There's good reason to believe it's not permanent. So we really, for immunity's sake, we need vaccines rather than natural immunity. But that's not, it's just not a viable strategy. There was a question they had noted that Health Officer of Kitsap County had put out some recommendations about testing, if you traveled to high prevalence areas. Are we considering the same thing? And first of all, we work very closely with our neighboring counties and try to kind of keep our protocols synchronized. And we're always looking for different testing strategies. And fundamentally, the people we want to get tested are people with symptoms and people who have been exposed to confirmed cases. It's hard to assess the risk of someone whose exposure is just that they went to Los Angeles or they did particular travel, because it really matters much more what you did. If you spent your night unmasked in nightclubs in Los Angeles, that's a high-risk exposure, and you should be tested. If you were careful and masked and distanced, your exposure risk is probably very low, and it doesn't make sense. So we're trying to figure those things out. But in general, people should always be tested. They should be quarantined, in fact, if they've been exposed to a confirmed case. But they should consider, if they've been in a high-risk situation, then it's appropriate to consider testing. And there are situations, too, when people have been traveling and on airlines, and then they're going to come back and be the caretaker for a vulnerable population. Testing makes some sense in those situations, but the safest thing in those situations is to quarantine for 2 weeks before you resume that activity as a caretaker of someone you know who's at high risk for complications. And then final question, are we doing things to protect senior facilities, jails, and other community settings? And then it cites an outbreak in Great Falls, Montana. And yes, we've been doing that from the very beginning. And that's how we found out about how lethal this was in Washington State and nursing home outbreaks. And so we've had intensive programs. We screen employees and residents of nursing homes randomly and on a regular basis. There's very strict protocols about who can go in and out of nursing homes, and they use very strict infection control in nursing homes. And still we see outbreaks in nursing homes. You know, so it's a continuous process of trying to learn how to protect those populations. Likewise in jails and prisons. You know, that's a high-risk situation. So we've been doing a lot of different things from the very beginning. In county jails, one of the most important things is what they call decongesting. And that is just, you know, reducing the number of people in jail. Really putting in people in jail only if they're a public safety risk. And not just for things that if they're not a public safety risk, it's better for them not to be in jail, because the fewer people you have in jail, the more spread out people are in jails, the less likely you are to have outbreaks. But the jails are kind of doing everything they know how to do, and they have medical providers there to help them with it, because it's happened, especially prison outbreaks we've seen in this state, less so in county jails, but that's always a risk. So that's it for the questions.
Great, thank you, Dr. Locke. You know, one question we periodically get on the county's Facebook page is sort of about the criteria for getting tested, and I know you've addressed this quite a few times, but could you just kind of reiterate the changing criteria that Jefferson Healthcare uses and talk about where options that people have? I know the nurse hotline, and I forget the private clinic, that if they just want to get a test, they can go to it. But could you dig into that just a moment for us?
Sure. We've decided in Jefferson County that we very closely follow the state's guidelines, you know, which are continuously being revised, but the state's guidelines sort of represent this science-based approach to testing, and it's really looking at risk factors. So we, because of the limitations of testing, that it does not pick up every case. It may miss as many as 30% of low-grade infections will test negative. We have to be very careful that people do not look at testing as somehow this clean bill of health. You know, that so if they test negative, that means they couldn't possibly have it, because that's never the case. So we do testing to find infection more than to rule it out. And that's a hard concept to get across. Testing, though, for anyone who wants it is becoming increasingly available in the private sector. So people who just want to kind of test themselves for whatever reason will have more and more access to doing that. Now, I don't necessarily recommend that. You have to be careful in how you interpret it. But Our strategy has been to use statewide standards and that are science-based, but always consider revisions. Over time, the state has been expanding their testing criteria more and more.
Great, thank you. Go ahead, Kate.
Can I ask a follow-up to that? Is there any concern that more widely available testing could lead to more reckless behavior?
Yes, absolutely. Is people who test negative may think, okay, they're not at risk of transmitting. And as I said, they may in fact be infected. They may be less infectious than other people, but still they could transmit, say, in a household setting or close contact. It's just that they're less likely to be a super spreader in a public setting. So that's the limitation of testing. As your risk factors go up, if you're sick with something, the odds of the test being accurate, if in fact you test positive, go up. It's just one of many tools, but the best thing of all is prevention. That's what we have to put our major strategy into, is to try to limit the spread of the infection.
It seems like we're in a situation similar to last summer, where Jefferson County's doing relatively better, but throughout the country, we're having a big upswing in cases. And I see the temptation to want to open things up more out there. The state was going to have more discussions about opening up more this week, weren't they?
This evening, in fact, or 5 o'clock, we're going to have a statewide meeting on that. And you're absolutely right. Our prevalence is around, it's been in this 25 cases per 100,000 range. It's in King County right now, it's 93 per 100,000. It's over 100 in Pierce County. So that's what we're dealing with. And those are huge counties too. So that means that there are, tens of thousands of people with the infection at a given time, and more opportunity to come in contact with.
I have one other question. That's just, we spend, as our daughter wants to go to Halloween parties and things like that, we spend a lot of time kind of calculating our own risk exposure. And I think a lot of people that I've spoken with, maybe it's partly the fatigue or something, but they kind of look, well, if my kid's going to school, then I'm out there already, so I can have this other gathering too, and it's okay because the genie's out of the bottle. But I continue to look at risk factors kind of as a multiplying factor rather than an additive factor. Each group of five that my daughter hangs out with multiplies her potential exposure, and both directions. And I guess I was wondering if you could just speak a little bit to for everyone, I guess, as we're kind of negotiating, managing, evaluating risk, and how we should look at as we open up some areas. How should we process other risk?
Yeah, people are revisiting that because there is an argument to having kind of a social pod that you create of, trusted friends and family and where everyone agrees to follow some very strict kind of rules. But outside those kind of social pods, risk does increase by more of a multiplication factor. It's actually the math involves if you remember factorials from algebra, it expands really rapidly. It's not just simple addition, because you have links to all the different people. Every person in the group is potentially exposing every other person. And so, But if none of them are infected, then no exposure or transmission occurs. So that's what, community prevalence is really important from that respect. But it's, I think people are going to revisit it. You know, people are really sick of the strict isolation. And so people are looking at these social pod ideas, and it's not unreasonable, but you have to be careful with it. And it's the random interactions with strangers that is the most dangerous thing, because there you cannot calculate the risk. You have no idea what their risk behaviors are.
Great. Go ahead, Phil. Oh, you're muted, I think. Just a note to remind everybody that we are heading into flu season. I got my flu shot yesterday. So if the flu vaccine is available locally, I know there was a slow rollout on it, but it is now available. So just a reminder to folks that it's important to get your flu shot. And Dr. Locke, can you talk about sort of the emerging ability to differentiate between flu and COVID symptoms for testing purposes?
We really can't do it based on symptoms. The symptom profile of COVID is so broad that it can look exactly like flu or the common cold. So when people are sick with respiratory infections, we will be testing them for COVID in addition to influenza in many cases. And then there's all these common cold viruses too that will cause a similar pattern. So on the positive side, you know, people who adhere to the masking and distancing and hand washing can expect to have a lot fewer respiratory infections this year than they had in previous years, because all of those things protect you from all respiratory viruses, not just COVID-19.
We've talked about this before, but just a reminder, therefore, the importance of getting a flu vaccine to reduce the incidence of flu and reduce the need for testing and saving our capacity and ensuring that we get rapid turnaround on the test by not overwhelming the system.
Absolutely. And you know, influenza is a killer. Influenza kills tens of thousands of people each year. So our goal is to have a very, very mild influenza season like they did in the Southern Hemisphere. And that's going to take broad-based flu vaccinations. And there appears to be an ample supply that the U.S. has manufactured almost 200 million doses of flu vaccine. So everyone who's willing to get it, you know, it should be available. But as you say, it'll roll out. There'll be spot shortages, but they'll only last for a week or two. And then
it'll be available now.
Yeah.
All right. And I will, looks like we're coming up to our 10:30 hearing quick, but we haven't heard from Willie. So we might be just a minute late in getting that hearing going. But any last questions for Dr. Locke? All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Locke. Educational as always, and we'll welcome Willie Benz. Are you on the line?
Hey, yes, sir. Thank you, Commissioner.
Take it away.
Just real quick, it was mostly a routine week last week for us. Our big activity was what I had mentioned last week. We reached out to the local school jurisdictions to offer support. For those of you who weren't with us last week, the state EOC finally allowed us to provide PPE to local school districts to help support their operations. So we conducted some outreach. We were able to place a couple of orders for PPE for local school districts. The purpose of this program isn't to necessarily supply them long-term. It's to help out with kind of immediate unmet needs. So this isn't necessarily for, you know, the rest of the school year. More of a stopgap until they're able to source things through other commercial vendors and more regular means. So we were able to help out a little bit last week. This week, though, there will be a pause in our PPE ordering. As the state EOC is actually moving its supply warehouse this week. So we were able to, again, support our schools and support some of our other partners as part of our regular PPE process last week. We're going to take a little bit of a breather this week while they move, and look to resume that starting next week. Other than that, the only thing I did want to mention real quick, Dr. Locke kind of already addressed it. We do have Halloween coming up, and then next month is Thanksgiving, and then looking forward even longer, we have Christmas, Hanukkah, and the rest of the holiday season, which are going to present some challenges. We'll be putting some links and some other information out on our community situation report. Again, that's released every Monday, and I know public health will be doing a lot of messaging. So for those of you who are curious, concerned, et cetera, be sure to keep an eye out because there's a lot of good advice coming out for how to handle those upcoming events. As far as winter as a whole, we are expecting a winter that's supposed to be likely to be a little bit wetter and a little bit colder than average, which will likely drive people farther indoors as the weather begins to change. However, those predictions are for the winter climate as a whole. So we will see periods of maybe dry, slightly warmer weather. We will definitely see some winter storms that are going to dump a lot of water and be pretty cool. So my advice to folks is continue to take kind of a long-term look at things. When there is no rain, get outside while you can to kind of help preserve your mental health, ease the burden as we continue to fight this thing and try to do our best to prevent the spread of COVID-19. So when I have a little bit more time, maybe next week we can talk about the upcoming winter season and kind of holiday mitigation efforts as a whole. But for the time being, I'll just leave it at that.
Brian Phillip?
Yeah, just a public announcement that with the coronavirus relief funds, there is the opportunity for local businesses that have been impacted by COVID to apply for small grants through our EDC, Team Jefferson EDC. The website for that is www.edcteamjefferson.org. So, again, www.edcteamjefferson.org, all one word. And those are outright grants for businesses that have been financially impacted by the COVID pandemic. So, and that's almost all businesses. So there is funding available, and the deadline for filing for a grant, applying for a grant, has been extended by the EDC, and they've got funding available, so please take advantage of it. And also, commissioners, as we are wrapping up on a COVID update, just a reminder, we have yet to do the consent agenda.
Yeah, I think we'll probably take that after the hearing. So thank you very much, Willie, for the update. Any last questions for Willie or Dr. Locke? All right. You guys have a great week. Appreciate your time this morning, and we will and thank you to the listeners of KPTZ as well, and we'll return you to your regularly scheduled.
We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the